You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an expert on protest movements joins the show for a look at the ongoing protests against racial injustice and how they compare with movements of the past. Now, it used to be pretty easy to find ourselves constantly busy in our business-as-usual lives. There are always more errands to run, a different place to go out to dinner, plans with friends, lessons to attend. Many of us might have been a little guilty of treating busyness like a virtue. But the last few months have created an experiment of sorts. With the coronavirus pandemic, we're getting a glimpse into what happens when a lot of that comes to a forced stop, when there are fewer things we're able to do and when we're confined to our homes, either by public policy or by personal choice. Many people have been experiencing a bit of a forced slowdown, something that happens rarely. Some people say this slowdown might be just what we need. Alan Lightman is a writer and physicist who teaches at MIT. He's the author of several books, including Einstein's Dreams and In Praise of Wasting Time. He wrote the piece, The Virus is a Reminder of Something Lost Long Ago, for The Atlantic. We talked to him in April. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first, Alan, about the pace of life in what we might think of as normal times. You write that it is sped up a lot, but in many ways, we didn't really notice it. Can you talk about how we got caught up in this high-speed, busy way of life?
Well, I think that the pace of life has always been regulated by the speed of communication. And the speed of communication has been getting faster and faster and faster. And I think it's happened almost invisibly. I think the time equal money equation has also put a premium on the commercial use of time. And I think, like so many other things in modern life, new technology comes along and we just accept it. It becomes part of our lives. I don't think that we can even remember what life was like before the smartphone. So we just adapt and we don't think about the larger consequences.
We see a lot of innovation in how we use technology, including the information technology you were talking about. But you also talk about innovation in a different way in the habits of our minds, which can be mm-hmm. hard to shake up and use in a new way. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the forced staying at home, we're being forced by the coronavirus to slow down our lives. And our routines are disrupted. Of course, those of us who are staying at home are lucky compared to the frontline workers, the hospital workers, and the people in grocery stores and so on. With time on our hands, we find ourselves alone with our thoughts, and we have the opportunity to think about things that we don't normally think about. What is important to us? What are our values? Where are we going? Those questions sound kind of trivial in a way, but they're very important. And I think that in the fast pace of the modern world, that many of us haven't had the time to think about questions like that, to think about who we really are and where we're going. And I think that applies to the country as a whole, as well as to individual people, that our country has an inner life, but it's not really aware of it. This is long before the coronavirus, long before the Trump administration. I think that our country as a whole has lost its way because it has not thought about what our real values are. So that happens at a national level as well as at the level of the individual.
I think at the individual level, and I'm guilty of this myself, there's a sense that if I'm doing nothing, I'm not doing any kind of activity, I'm just there and thinking, I'm wasting my time. I'm frittering away a valuable resource. How do we shake ourselves out of that mindset? How do I do that?
Well, that feeling that wasting time is almost sinful, that goes back to our Puritan roots, where working was the only thing that had value. But actually, I think wasting time does have value. And when we talk about wasting time, I mean anything that is not goal-directed. a time where you're just letting your mind spin, where you're imagining, you're dreaming, you're remembering things, important experience in your life. You might be reading a book. You might be having a quiet conversation with someone. Just because you're not checking off items on your to-do list doesn't mean that the time is not valuable. And we really need that time. We need to replenish our minds, which is an idea that the Buddhists have had for thousands of years. I think we're more creative when we're letting our imaginations wander. And we're also nourishing our inner self, that part of us that thinks about what's important to us.
We're talking to author and physicist Alan Lightman. His books include Einstein's Dreams and In Praise of Wasting Time. He says our safer at home times during the coronavirus could be a wake up call to the need to slow down, take some time to do nothing in our daily lives. Alan, in that piece you wrote in The Atlantic, you talk about some creative people who got a lot out of having that nothing time. Can you give us some examples of people who did great stuff because they took the time to not do anything?
Yes. Well, psychologists have always known that creativity thrives on the imagination, on I won't say wasting time, but just sort of being at rest in time. Gustav Mahler, the composer, used to take 3-hour walks after lunch where he got some of his best musical ideas. There are many other people who have found that getting away from their normal routines has allowed them to think new thoughts. Einstein also talked about how when he let his mind wander, that he sometimes had some of his best ideas. Gertrude Stein, the writer, used to take drives in the countryside and just look at cows when she was in the middle of a writing project. So those are a few examples.
So it seems like there's a paradox here. If we fill our times to the brim and think of ourselves as always being productive, we're going to be less productive if we don't have that time that lets us do that kind of creative thinking you're talking about.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in fact, some companies in the U.S. have instituted meditation rooms where they allow their employees for a half an hour a day to just stop working and to go into one of these rooms without their smartphones and just have quiet time. And they have found that that actually increases productivity. So it's exactly the irony that you mentioned. By having working a little bit less, but having that extra time to just allow our minds to replenish themselves, to have creative thoughts that were actually more productive.
We're revisiting a conversation with Alan Lightman, a writer and physicist who teaches at MIT. He's the author of several books, including Einstein's Dreams and In Praise of Wasting Time. He wrote the piece, The Virus is a Reminder of Something Lost Long Ago, for The Atlantic. We want to hear from you. As our usual schedules and world slowed down, did you feel a change of mindset? Did you enjoy maybe a feeling of having less to do? Has it changed your daily life and habits? And have you noticed more about yourself, about your own needs or ideas or creativity? Tweet us at Central Time WPR, that's Central Time WPR, and let us know. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to our recent conversation with Alan Lightman, writer and physicist who teaches at MIT. He's the author of several books, including Einstein's Dreams and In Praise of Wasting Time. He wrote the piece, The Virus is a Reminder of Something Lost Long Ago, for The Atlantic. Have you felt like you're living in the moment now? Has the forced slowdown given you more time to notice things, maybe about yourself, your life? Have you enjoyed having time to waste? Have you felt a boost in your creativity? Are you itching to get back to what you thought of as normal life before? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Alan, for people who aren't used to doing this, who maybe as an exercise try taking the time to do nothing, whatever their version of nothing is, and feel restless and want to reach for the cell phone or feel silly and wasteful doing it, do you have some advice, some thoughts on how we can break through that and do nothing right.
Yeah, well, one thing is just to take 30 minutes a day for a walk. I know that in the time of the coronavirus that some of us don't have places to walk, but that will pass. But if you do have a place that you can walk safely, do not take your smartphone with you, and just see where your mind goes. Another thing that we can do is have a quiet dinner hour. The dinner hour may be only 30 minutes, but however long it is, to turn off all of your devices and just have a quiet conversation during dinner time. So those are a couple of ways that we can that are fairly painless to build into our lives to see how it feels.
With that pace of the flow of information we were talking about earlier, there is, you know, there's that phrase, the fear of missing out. Given the volume of news coming in, either, you know, news from around the world, or, you know, what are our friends up to or anything like that, it can feel like that time away from the phone, we're missing so much. How do we break out of that mindset?
Well, that is a problem. And I know that fear of missing out is a psychological problem, especially among our young people who send about 100 text messages a day. I think the only solution to that is try turning off your phone for 15 minutes and see whether you can survive it.
Let's bring out a caller. And Leah is with us in Ettrick. Leah, hello.
Hi. See, I just wanted to say that your guest speaker hit the nail on the head with having downtime, stopping, smelling the roses, breathing. With the coronavirus, you know, most people will never get the opportunity again to be able to, you know, stay at home. I am an essential worker, but I was able to take 6 weeks off at the beginning of the year for a medical procedure. And, you know, it was amazing. It was amazing having the time off and being able to stop and think and plan and, you know, just slow your life down. So I love what your caller has been talking about. It's been right at my alley. So thank you for the great perspective.
And Leah, before you go, I want to ask, you know, you had that time, that 6 weeks there. Has that changed how you are? You're working again, but when you're off work, do you still feel some of the effects of that time off? Did it change the way you think of your time off?
Oh, yeah, it totally changed the way I think. And I mean, it actually got me started on a weight loss journey where I lost like 31 pounds in 3 months because I was able to stop and think, you know, before you put food in your mouth and just, you know, be a healthier version of yourself. It makes you reflect and have time to, you know, like you said, sit down and read a book and stop and think about, you know, what's important in life. And I'm very thankful for that time off to stop and rediscover, because with all the running that you do with your kids and sports and, you know, it's like I said, it's invaluable. And I just hope that people realize that, take it and enjoy it if you have it, because like I said, you're not going to get the opportunity again.
Leah, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Alan, your thoughts on what Leah had to say there.
Well, first of all, I want to salute her as being an essential worker, because all of the rest of us are dependent on Leah and people like her. Leah mentioned that this is the only opportunity we're going to have to take time off. What I hope might come out of this strange period that we're living in now is a change in our habit of mind, an appreciation that quiet time when we're reflecting on what's important to us and what our values are, time that we're unplugged from the internet, that is valuable time. And if we can recognize it as valuable time, maybe we can build that into our lives, that idea, long after the coronavirus is gone. So I hope that this will be a permanent change in the way that we think about our lives and what's important to us.
As you write about this and think about this and talk to other people, do you feel like there's a hunger out there for this kind of thinking, this slower pace, appreciating time doing nothing that we may not have realized was there in the first place?
I do think there's a hunger for it, but I think that we are battling the time equal money equation, which is part of the U.S. obsession with money and materiality, that since the Industrial Revolution, that time has been translated into money. And so I think one of the forces that is driving the lifestyle, the frantic lifestyle that we have now, is the feeling that we can make more money by using time productively. And so I think that is powerful force is battling the other desire that people have, which is to slow down their life and not just checking off boxes on their to-do list every day. So we have those two powerful opposing forces.
It's a good place to leave it. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me on your program.
Alan Lightman is a writer and physicist who teaches at MIT. He's the author of several books, including Einstein's Dreams and In Praise of Wasting Time. He wrote the piece, The Virus is a Reminder of Something Lost Long Ago, for The Atlantic. We revisited a conversation we had with him earlier this year. During the COVID-19 pandemic, one of the questions WPR has been getting most often through the Why Wisconsin Project is this: is it safe to visit with family and friends, especially now that more and more places are loosening restrictions on the size of public gatherings and the capacity of shops and restaurants? WPR's Bridget Bowden has been talking with experts to get some answers to this question. She talked to All Things Considered host Brady Carlson.
Bridget, what are these experts saying about the questions we should be asking ourselves if we're thinking about getting together with others?
So one of the experts I spoke to was Malia Jones, who is an assistant scientist in health geography at the Applied Population Lab at the UW-Madison. And she actually studies how the places we spend our time affect our health and how diseases spread in those places. She says it's generally okay right now to visit with family and friends, but you do need to consider how much exposure to the virus you have had and what type of risk the people you want to visit with are facing. Like, it's probably not a good idea to go to a big pool party and then visit your at-risk grandparents in the same week. But all the experts I've spoken to say that there are things that public health professionals called harm reduction strategies that can really reduce that risk. So here's what she says.
So this is the idea that, okay, you're going to engage in some kind of activity that might be a little risky. What can you do to reduce that risk?
What are the strategies that will lower the risk of spreading the virus when you're around others?
There are four main things that the experts I've spoken to say that you can do to reduce that risk. The first one is to gather outdoors instead of indoors. With the wind blowing around, those droplets have a much lower chance of reaching the person who you're gathering with. Keeping everyone as far apart as possible, up to 6 feet if you can. Another thing that you can do is keep your visits to a pretty small group. So, you know, maybe visit with one or two or three people instead of having a big party in your backyard. And then, of course, wearing a face mask or covering is something that the experts are saying now does quite a bit to prevent those droplets from spreading.
And that can be true even if you're going to part of the state that has different rules than the one you live in.
Yeah. Malia Jones, who I spoke to, says that travel is generally okay as long as you do some of those harm reduction strategies. Here's what she said.
Those county boundaries are not meaningful to a virus. My best advice is really to do those harm reduction strategies, even if you're going to a place where they're not required.
What about those of us with younger kids in the house? I mean, that certainly changed the calculus for me about where I go and don't go these days.
Right. Kids make all of this a lot more complicated. You know, it's really difficult to get a kid to stay 6 feet away. One recommendation that I've heard from the experts is if you're thinking of bringing your kids to, say, visit their grandparents or visit someone who may be higher risk, maybe for the 2 weeks before you do that visit, you should do a strict isolation where your kids aren't seeing anyone else, just to make sure that you're not going to bring that virus to your at-risk grandparent or loved one.
And if there is a resurgence of COVID-19 cases, do we then go back to the drawing board with what's acceptable and what isn't?
Right. It's kind of complicated because right now, all the experts I've spoken to say it's generally okay to go visit your loved ones if you do the harm reduction strategies and be as careful as you can. But if Wisconsin were to become a hotspot or a place where people were doing those harm reduction strategies still had a spike in cases, it may be time to back off those visits. So Malia Jones actually said she expects the guidance to kind of go up and down over time.
I expect it to fluctuate. And I think everybody needs to assess for themselves what's going on around them, what kind of exposures they have recently had.
This conversation was informed by audience questions as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. You can send us your questions or concerns about COVID-19 and find all of our coverage of the pandemic here in Wisconsin at WPR.org. Tomorrow at 4:30, we'll talk to a doctor and virology expert about the uptick in Wisconsin's positive test rate and what precautions people should be taking. You'll be able to join in with your questions, too. That's tomorrow at 4:30. Coming up, protests spread quickly after the killing of George Floyd. But our guest says they didn't come out of nowhere. An expert on social movements digs into the current wave of protests and some of the history that it's built on and how it compares to protest movements of the past. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Harley-Davidson is seen as an iconic Wisconsin brand, but it's faced some big challenges in recent years with the coronavirus making things even worse. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the future of the motorcycle company and what it means for workers and the economy here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the killing of George Floyd and the video of his last minutes sparked a huge wave of protests around the country and around the world. Those protests still continue in many American communities. But what does it take for a protest movement to translate into real changes in policies and in culture at large? David S. Meyer is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine, where he studies social movements, political sociology, and public policy. You can follow his blog at politicsoutdoors.com. David, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
What was it about this moment that led to this really seemingly spontaneous wave of protests in the Midwest, around the country, and then around the world?
I think there were a lot of things that came together in an unexpected way. One thing was the graphic and very, very disturbing video of George Floyd's throat being crushed. And it came right after the story of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky and right after Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. So I think that people were tuned into it in a way they wouldn't have been otherwise. And remember, it came in the middle of this pandemic when people have been at home watching more TV, watching more videos than ever before. So the message transmitted more quickly and people were ready to get out and do something. And then we have to remember the organizing on Black Lives Matter that had been going on since 2013, since Trayvon Martin, which had been promoting criticism of racialized police violence, with lots and lots of cases in between now and in between then and now. So I think there was a lot of loading up of capacity that was ready to take off when the right spark hit.
Right. I use the phrase out of nowhere, but as you've written, as you just said, this wasn't out of nowhere. This built on years of Black Lives Matter protests and a longer, historical civil rights movement here in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about how precursors like early Black Lives Matter protests can lead to something bigger down the road?
Well, what happened is that the Black Lives Matter was a hashtag that was started by three women activists that was in response to the killing of Trayvon Martin by an independent security guy, not a police officer, so a wannabe police officer. And it spread a message about violence against black people, sometimes police violence. And that message was picked up in all kinds of surprising ways. I mean, it doesn't take much to think back and remember LeBron James and Dwayne Wade wearing hoodies with the rest of the Miami Heat, the team they were both then on, to draw attention to Trayvon Martin's killings. And then later, when Eric Gardner was strangled on video by a police officer in Staten Island, you also saw the I Can't Breathe shirts that basketball players were wearing. And it went across social media, got a lot of attention, not a lot of policy response right away, but it brought attention to the issue. And that was important in setting up circumstances which activists today could take advantage of. There's another piece of it that I think is important, which is that there was an unprecedented resistance to Donald Trump as president, which started before he became president and certainly took off with the Women's March and then the March of the Week every week afterwards in Washington, and then organizing in congressional districts through Indivisible and other groups. So there are a lot of people who didn't necessarily come to protest with a particular concern about racialized police violence, but were already polarized and ready to take action against the current administration. I think it made it possible for the Black Lives Matter activists to build a broader coalition than they had been able to build in the past.
A challenge for any protest movement is, what message are you sending? Do you have a cohesive message, specific policy guidelines? And that's hard with decentralized protests where people are showing up maybe with different agendas, different ideas, big goals, small goals. Does that get in the way for this or any other movement of making change?
Well, that's always the way it happens. I mean, when we look back in history, we tend to smooth out the rough spots in protest movements. But protest, particularly big events, always are broad coalitions with people who have different priorities in terms of what issue are they working on. Are they working on racial justice? Are they working on economics? Are they working on the environment? Big demonstrations of today, all those things are together. And how far do they want to go? And again, there's always a broad spectrum. When we look back, we take look back at 1963 and we take a line out of Martin Luther King's speech and say, oh, he was just against bigotry. Well, that was a march for guaranteed jobs for everyone also, which we can forget if we're not paying attention. So what happens always is that opponents will pick on what they think are the most divisive claims that somebody at a demonstration has, and you're never going to get all the things you ask for. But the synergy of lots of different claims, different people, different goals, creates a pressure for government to do something. And when we look back, we might think that that's all the protest movement wanted. It almost never is.
We're talking to David Meyer, sociologist and expert on social movements and protest at the University of California, Irvine, looking at the current protests against police brutality and racial injustice, how they compare to movements of the past. I want to give a listen to a Wisconsin politician, Wisconsin State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican, speaking in Madison. This is this week, the morning after a protest that ultimately included the toppling of two statues in Madison on the Capitol Square and an attack on Democratic State Senator Tim Carpenter. Here's a listen.
We know that in the United States and Wisconsin and every community around our state, peaceful protest is one of the ways that change occurs. but violent protest, where a mob forms and government refuses to act, is the exact opposite of how change will occur. For those people who decided that the way to express themselves was through criminal acts and things that the entire state of Wisconsin now looks at our capital city in shock and awe, that is something that should never be tolerated. It should have never gotten to this point.
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss there. And again, this is a common theme in protests and protest movements when violence of some sort breaks out. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, when Robin Voss is giving advice to protesters for social justice, you can't assume that he's really looking out for your best interests. When people said, oh, I respect Colin Kaepernick's right to protest, just not about the flag, not where anybody can see it. Those people are not trying to help Colin Kaepernick be effective. Robin Voss is not looking out for your interests. And there's something disingenuous about it. They haul out a picture of Martin Luther King and they say, oh, Martin Luther King was peaceful. Well, Martin Luther King was crazy, unpopular, and under surveillance for the last 10 years of his life. So it's a constructed recollection that's really false, and it's used to discredit what people are after now. One. Two, any big movement draws up lots of people in its wake and cannot control all the people who come into a large demonstration. Demonstrations don't have bouncers like bars where they can say, oh, you have to leave. And it is very much the work of opponents to try to discredit an entire movement based on some element that they find offensive. So that's worth thinking about. And this is not new. What were the statues that people were going after?
It was of Hans Hegg, a Wisconsin Union commander, and the Forward statue, kind of a woman representing the spirit of Wisconsin. We don't have, you know, Confederate general statues on the Capitol Square.
I don't see any immediate problem with those statues, and I think there was probably unbridled and undisciplined enthusiasm by some people who were there. I don't know all the stories of those people, but if you don't have a reasonable process for reconsidering the statues that somebody thought were a good idea at some time, then you're going to get citizen movements to try to make their own decisions about it.
We're talking to sociologist and political science professor David Meyer about the politics of protest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What to you makes an effective protest? Have you demonstrated in the current round of protests or protests against COVID-19 related restrictions? Or do you have a protest history going back maybe as far as the 60s or further? Tell us your story, what you think works, what doesn't, what a protester, what a demonstration can do to win your agreement on an issue or what it can do to turn you away. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the effectiveness of protests with Professor David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in protests this year or in the past? What was your experience like? Why did you do it? Do you feel like it led to the changes you were hoping for as you watch protests on the news, on TV, wherever? What do you think of what's going on now? Do you worry when violence breaks out or looting? Does that tar the image of the protesters in your mind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. David, something we've talked about in the past is social media and how that has changed, or maybe in some cases not so much changed, protests. So what do you make of the current state of social media when it comes to protest?
Well, it's amazing that some people have found creative new ways to protest under the restrictions of COVID. I was really moved by the TikTok K-pop teen Trump ticket troll which I mean, that's a name I just made up. I don't know if it's really what they called it, where the where young people across the United States signed up for the Trump rally and then didn't show up. And it was, you're thinking about these kids, 16, 17, 18, who have been cheated by COVID out of some of the delights of senior year of high school, and they're communicating with each other about Trump and trying to find some way to do something. And it was mostly under the radar of people like me. If we're not on TikTok, if we're not on Instagram, they have ways of getting their own message across and their own media across. So that's something that's exciting. But there's also a nasty underside to it, because we don't all operate with the same facts. So social movement becomes a belief system where you can get information that confirms your pre-existing ideas about what's dangerous, about whether masks are dangerous or not dangerous, in which there's no gatekeeper and no necessary expertise, but you get confirmation of the belief you're starting with. So in Wisconsin, I believe you've seen Black Lives Matter protests after George Floyd, and you've seen the Open Up protests too. And I don't think those people are talking to each other or reading the same media.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Joe on the line in Onalaska. Joe, hi. Joe, are you there?
No, this is Steve from Sun Prairie.
Oh, Steve, yeah, let's go with you. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, one of the things that really bothers me is there's a walk-away campaign that's been out there for a few years, and I'm one of them. I was a Democrat, and I left the party. And part of the reason why I left is the hate. The absolutely hate that's ginned up by that party. I know you're gassing and turning into Trump, but it's the Democratic Party. For the guest to make a comment that Robin Voss doesn't have your best interest at mind, I agree a lot with Robin Voss, so therefore he's saying I don't have people's best interest at mind. And that's just hateful. Two good people can disagree on a political solution. Doesn't make one evil and the other one good. That stuff's got to stop.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Do you think, David, that we end up in terms of good and evil?
It's a very, very polarized time. And social movements enhance the polarization, and the Trump administration has also enhanced the polarization. And it means that people take sides, and they often neglect inconsistencies on their own side, and they often overstate the evils of their opponents. But I haven't seen anything that makes me reconsider what I said about Robin Voss.
Thanks for calling in, Steve. We'll go to Joe for real now in Onalaska. Joe, hi.
Hi, thanks for doing this. It's interesting. I think the premise of the question was what makes an effective protest. And I'm a former local government official, and I think there's a lot of noise. And I'm not poo-pooing the effectiveness of a nationwide protest, particularly this one. However, I think most of what is capable of being accomplished happens at the local level. And sometimes it's actually a hell of a lot easier if you get aggressively political at the local level because it requires less. I got elected, I think, one time with only about 90 votes. To a county position, even though I knocked on every door in the district, it's just there isn't a lot of turnout. And if you show up, I can count on one hand the number of times people wrote me and called me about an issue. And I think, many of these issues actually are local. And it really saddened me with those statues being torn down in the Capitol because, I support the goals, I think, generally speaking, of the people who are protesting to affect positive change with regard to law enforcement and Black Lives Matter and all that. However, these statues that were down at the Capitol stand for, women's right to vote. And the Colonel Haig, was somebody who was killed fighting against the Confederacy.
Joe, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time left. You gave us a lot to work with there. I want to key in on his first point there, David, about getting involved in local politics. I've seen anecdotally this time some people who have been involved in protests then saying, hey, I'm going to run for, you know, a state assembly seat or maybe local government. And as I seem to recall, the Tea Party, it brought some new people in to run for office who might not have run before. Do we often see that, protests leading to local political involvement?
Absolutely. I think Joe is right on target that like hard work at the local level, it's easier to accomplish your policy goals. And the stuff about police policy, a lot of it is done locally. So the idea of getting involved locally matters a lot. The national protests sometimes buoy up people and encourage them to run for office. So you mentioned the Tea Party, where people who came from a protest movement, some of them ran for office and some of them won. I was going through in 2017, I think it was, the Virginia House of Delegates, and I found five successful candidates just from their websites who said the reason they were running is they got excited about politics based on the Women's March. And so it's not protest or do institutional politics. It's usually do both. And if you want to be effective, you have to have people on your side doing both for sure.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about protests and what makes them effective. David Meyer with us from the University of California, Irvine. Back to your calls. Judy is with us in Grand Chute. Judy, hello.
Hello. I'm of the older generation. I was in college in the 60s when the anti-war protests were on. I agreed with their philosophy, but I did nothing. In retrospect, I'd certainly rather be sorry for something I did than for something I didn't do.
Judy, thanks for that call. So Judy regrets not having been involved in protests back in the 60s, David.
Well, I mean, it was a historic moment. It wasn't all pretty. It wasn't all clean. It did wind up mattering a great deal, and it affected politics since. I mean, it was the movement against the war in Vietnam that, according to Richard Nixon, stopped him from threatening the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. And it was the movement against the war in Vietnam that basically ended the draft in the United States.
Thanks a lot for that call, Judy, at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Dave in Green Bay. Dave, hi.
Hi. I guess I, too, support the protests. I support both movements that are going on. What I can't support is the rioting and the damage, and I'm afraid that they're going to lose Middle America. That Middle America can't support the damage that's going on, and it's going to actually hurt their cause in the long run because it's going to help somebody like a Donald Trump get reelected because he's taking a hardline stance on the police side. So that's my comment.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And this is again a common theme I think in protests, David, the worry that, you know, tactics of protesters might turn away otherwise persuadable people.
I don't think most of us like to see windows broken. I don't think most of us like to see people scuffling with police. I think that makes lots of people uncomfortable. In real life, however, when you get lots and lots of people out in the streets, police are called upon to do an extraordinary job, which is to provide protection and social control without making things worse. And the way police act has a lot to do with the way these demonstrations develop. So I think that, you know, the public image of protest matters a great deal, but I think when we look back in history, we tend to sanitize how sloppy and messy real protest movements are.
Thanks a lot for that call. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking to David S. Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He studies politics and social movements. You can follow his blog. PoliticsOutdoor.com is the website where you can see his writings from day to day. We talked to him today about the past and future of protests and how they can be effective. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of government contracts for personal protective equipment during the pandemic went to companies that couldn't deliver the goods. A ProPublica reporter shares some of those stories with us. A Wisconsin researcher tells us about her work with Sesame Street to help kids who have parents in jail or prison. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to find out how to make our own ice cream. And if I'm understanding correctly, there are ways to do it without actually having to buy our own ice cream maker. I've never taken the plunge, but if I can do it without doing that, I might could. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, if you want to go to a Wisconsin tourist attraction, but you're worried about the coronavirus pandemic, Kate's guest has some advice for you. Get some ideas on staying safe while seeing the sights. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, many people are working from home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Technology writer Clive Thompson joins the show to tackle the question, what if working from home never ends? I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.